All right, welcome back to Podcast Recovery, everyone. We are your hosts, David O.
And Eric B.
I almost said it for you.
I know, I see that. What the fuck's going on, man?
I don't know, man. Today we're joined from across the pond with our friend Richard. How you doing, man?
I'm great, guys. How are you?
I'm pretty good, man. It's snowing over here. We're about 5 hours behind you, but other than that, it's good, man. What's up? Nope. All right.
I was just saying the rain's coming down here, and we're meant to be getting snow, so and it's meant to be coming from America, so we'll wait and see.
Oh, nice. Where are you from?
I'm from Scotland, as you can probably tell by the accent, and I stay just outside Glasgow in Hamilton, Scotland.
Nice.
That's awesome.
And when were you first introduced to recovery?
I was first introduced to recovery last year, July last year, the 21st of July.
Nice.
And that was my first real introduction to it, yeah.
And how long have you been sober?
So just over 7 months now. So 19th of July last year was my sober date. So yeah, it's been an amazing journey in 7 months.
Hell yeah, man.
That's awesome.
Congratulations. Well, with all that out of the way, we're going to turn it over to you to share your story. Share your story with us, man. So take it away.
Yeah, well, thanks very much, first of all, for asking me to be part of the podcast. This is my first venture into this sort of thing. I suppose my journey started off just a normal family setting, really. And then when I was five, it was just me and my mum. After that, my dad left us. Out of the ordinary there. A lot of people have that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved around quite a bit. Actually spent a bit of time in Canada, where I have family.
Oh, really?
Before we came back to Scotland. And I grew up in a really nice place in Perthshire, in Scotland, called Crieff. And
nice.
That's where I spent most of my young years in my teens.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there that, probably like most people, I got introduced to alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm looking back on it through recovery, I can kind of see the progression that alcohol had with me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really always feel as if I kind of belonged or was able to fit in at school. Don't know why. There was no real reason for it. I just had this kind of feeling that other people were either friendly with each other or whatever it was. And as soon as I started to drink, really, when I was about maybe 15, I took my first proper drink.
What was your first drink?
What was my first drink? It was probably something really, really bland, just normal beer. Lager, as they call it over here, but
mm-hmm.
it wasn't anything, spectacular, but it was that feeling that it gave me.
Oh, yeah.
It just kind of made me feel, I suppose, complete, and it allowed me to kind of get out my shell. I was always quite a talkative person, but I think I always had this slight shyness, so I compensated for that, but when I drank, I kind of felt as if I could just be me, well, at least for half the night, and then it would always descend into a blackout. And I was always, blacking out, and that's what I just thought was normal, to be honest. I just thought that was the normal drinking pattern, because I'd always done it. Right from my first drink, I'd always blacked out, so it wasn't unusual for me, therefore it became my norm,
mm-hmm.
and that was how I lived my life, and it just was my go-to relaxer, was to have a drink.
It
didn't matter what the occasion was, and didn't matter what was happening in my life. it always had to involve alcohol. And if I didn't get that, you know, that drink, or if there wasn't going to be a drink on offer, whether it was a family or function or whatever it was, mm-hmm. it just, oh, you know that, you know that feeling that you get that you just don't want to be there.
Oh,
for no
yeah.
other reason other than it's not going to be alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I had that for so long, you know. My life was good. I mean, I left school when I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually went over and spent 6 months in Vancouver, where my family were at the time. So I kind of moved back over to Canada for 6 months.
Yeah, nice.
And being a Scotsman in North America is very easy for to get drink.
Yeah.
It comes with the accent, I think. And I just played on that, you know,
yeah.
to be honest with you. And I had lots of times where I was just constantly drinking, you know, through everything.
Yeah.
In regards to that, I came back to Scotland when I was 18 and just continued to drink. And I think it was just something that happens with the. You know, young people, it didn't really seem unusual at the time.
Yeah.
It was just something that we did.
What's the drink? What's the drinking age over there?
18.
That's the legal age?
Yeah, that's the legal age for drinking is 18. But I would say, I mean, I don't know what it's like, but... a lot of you know, places like the player I grew up in Crieff, I was drinking from when I was 16 in the local pub, and that was just, you know, again, that was just the norm in regards to what we were doing.
Yeah.
And it was just I don't know, I think in your mind you start to think, well, this is just, you know, culture. This is just what you do.
Yeah.
But the difference with me was when all my friends started to not do it, I continued to do it. And I think that was where the big difference came in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I suppose the big difference is that when friends or drinking buddies started to kind of grow up and stop drinking the way that I was still drinking, that started to highlight a different pattern and you know, my mindset more than anything.
Oh yeah.
And what I found was that I never really had any close friends because I would move around and drink with people who drank the same way as me.
Yeah.
Until they got fed up, probably with the way that I was drinking, because I was maybe even worse than them. and so then I would just have to move on, you know. So that just kind of proceeded and followed me for, you know, the whole time, you know. If I was in work environments, I would try and stay away from drinking as much as possible because I knew what would happen, you know. I had it in my mind that, you know, things that I was doing, you know, like blackouts and things like that, just weren't normal. You know, most people were staying a night and being able to go home, but I just had to continue.
You know,
as soon as I started, I just knew that was where I felt that I needed to be at that time.
Oh yeah.
My mind was just completely taken over by it all. But always thinking that it was me that was making all the choices and that I was in full control of everything that I was doing. You know, that was the biggest thing was being, you know, completely you know, self-absorbed, thinking that the things that I would do as a person, because I believe that I was a good person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I come from a family of church goers, and you know, my aunt's a Baptist minister in Canada, and you know, so I thought that I was a good person because that gave, you know, that I had a bit of a kind of upbringing in the church, so that's kind of where my mindset was, that I thought that I was a good guy, you know. But what I was, you know, certainly doing was just making sure that at the end of the day, no matter what I did, I always had that little reward, and that was always to have a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I thought that, you know, that was probably, you know, the most important thing.
It was like a safety blanket for you.
A safety blanket. That, you know, I suppose that warm hug and that release from the end of the day. You know, I could probably say that the anticipation of having a drink was just as good as having the drink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that feeling of knowing I was going to get a drink. And then, you know, cracking open that bottle of vodka, that for me was the start of the wind down, you know, like the start of me relaxing.
Yeah.
And then I would always say, I'll just have one.
Oh, yeah.
I'll have a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a couple, my mind would say, well, you know, the bottle's open now. I may as well just continue. Because, of course, I'm in control of that. You know, I'm the one making that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I never went into a shop to buy alcohol. It was a different... Don't know what it's like with yourself in the States. I know certainly in Canada they have the separate liquor stores. Is it the same with yourself? We have you know, alcohol liquor sold in just normal, you know, supermarkets, grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
So you would go in for, you know, some bread and milk, and you would just happen to pick up, you know, a box of beer or cider, or you know, because that's just what was, and you know, and I didn't even have the intention of doing it. You know, it would just happen.
Mm-hmm.
It would just be, just that natural thing. You know, it was just as natural to me as picking up, you know, food for my children, just to pick up alcohol. And that just kept on going, and the madness and the periods of time when I didn't drink, because I didn't drink every day.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't an every drinker. I could go for periods of time without drinking, mainly between Christmas and New Year and my birthday in April, because I probably made, you know, a right tit of myself.
Yeah.
Christmas and New Year.
Oh, yeah.
I would then, you know, not drink until April, and you would think, oh, that's fine, you know, 4 months, I've done good, you know, that's really great. But by the end of those 4 months, my partner would be saying to me, you'd be better off just having a drink.
Oof.
Because I was worse without it.
Oh, that's rough.
You know, I was angry, irritable. I was just thinking about it, because I knew that when I got to my birthday, then I could have a drink.
Yeah.
So it was that countdown to those days.
Oof.
And again, I just thought that, you know, if you kind of go along with these sporadic fads, like sober for October or dry January or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
That these sort of things were kind of the answer to my prayers, sort of thing, because I thought, well, I can do it for,
yeah,
I can do it for 4 weeks, so I don't have a problem, because I knew people and had family friends who I knew of that had alcohol problems and had sought help and didn't drink. And but I, that wasn't me because I could stop for periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
My problem was I couldn't stay stopped.
Yeah.
It was the staying stopped and living life without that drink that was the big problem for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that pattern just went on and on and on. And last summer, I would say was probably not my worst period of time of drinking, but I suppose I started to get worse when it came to, you know, coming off having a drink, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about, you know, DTs and withdrawal, really, because I didn't, in my mind, I wasn't suffering from anything. You know, I wasn't an alcoholic.
Mm.
I didn't have addiction problems. So when I was lying in bed and shaking and feeling like I just didn't want to move and all these things, I just thought, you know, had I had something bad to eat.
Yeah.
You know, all these excuses were in my mind because that wasn't. It just didn't occur to me because my mind kept saying, "Well, you're okay because you can stop
for
a couple of days, for a week, however long it is." And the biggest thing for me was last summer I went to a wedding, and for 2 weeks before the wedding I wasn't going to drink at the wedding, and I was really, really angry about this. You know, like I was so annoyed at the fact that I was not going to drink, and it came to the day of the wedding and I decided, you know what, I'm just going to have a couple of drinks. And the change in my mood was, I suppose looking back on it, quite scary.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had gone from being so low to making that one split decision, and then I was I just rocketed into, you know, the atmosphere. And, you know, it was just that, again, you know, the control that alcohol had over me, and I was just completely oblivious to it. You know, I had no idea that was what it was doing to me.
Yeah.
And then, again, it came a couple of weeks after that, and I was drinking again, because I don't work a Tuesday and a Wednesday, so my Tuesday night was just a night for having a couple of drinks. And it was always going to be a couple of drinks, but it never was a couple of drinks. I drank quite heavily, and I continued into the Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been the 18th of July, and I continued drinking quite heavily in the 18th of July. And it was just really bad, and it was that bad that what I was doing was something that I'd done before, but not in such an extent. You know, I was putting rum into my coffee because in my mind, I mean, at this point, you know, I thought this made perfect sense. You know, in my mind, I'm saying, well, the coffee will sober me up, and the rum will. And the rum will make me feel better, you know. And it was just complete insanity. It's the only way I can describe it, and that's just for myself, you know. Because if anybody had ever told me that I was going to be, you know, living in a house, I have a really nice partner, I have two kids, two dogs, I have an all right job, have a car in the driveway. But then, you know, inside, you know, behind closed doors was just, you know, this madness going on all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, trying to portray this perfect lifestyle.
Yeah.
That pressure was something that was just weighing heavily on me. And the kind of escape for me was that blackout.
Mm.
If I could get to blackout, then I wouldn't have to worry about that.
Ooh.
I wouldn't have to pretend anymore, because there wouldn't be anybody to pretend to, you know?
Yeah.
It was just me and my thoughts.
Mm.
And that you know, I've heard a lot of people talking about how when they were looking for answers, they may have thought that they had other things wrong with them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I can honestly say I never thought I had anything wrong with me, because I was that self-centred that I thought the rest of the world had everything wrong with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was the only one who had the answer. And the answer for me was to live the life that I was living.
Yeah.
You know, was to, you know, just, I think people always said, oh, you still want to be a teenager, or, you know, you just want to do that. And it wasn't that at all, you know. But it was just the fact that I had no control over what I thought I could control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd completely lost that ability to see what damage I was doing,
yeah.
You know, to myself and my family as well. And that was it. I was just completely blind to it.
Mm. Yep.
You know, and I suppose it is true that once you start trying to control something, it's at that point that I lost all control.
Mm.
Because for a long time I joined Facebook pages and read stuff about, you know, addiction and alcoholism, and I looked for all the differences. You know, I would sit and I would see people posting things and sharing, you know, like the way that, you know, your podcast does, and the way that I share now and think to myself, oh, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't do that.
Yeah.
And I would look for all the differences, but, you know, it was me. I was the guy who would happily say as a joke that I was a functioning alcoholic because I kept a job.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because that qualified me to drink the way that I drank, because I had a job.
Mm-hmm.
I would have a laugh and a joke about it with people, and I suppose people don't really know how to... Well, I suppose the holy grail is being able to be like a normal drinker for me, you know, somebody that can have two drinks and put it down and go home. You know,
yeah.
that to me is...
Yeah.
That's, you know, I was recently out at a wedding reception, and there was actually people, you know, drinking two or three drinks in the whole night, and I didn't, you know, have any desire to have anything to drink, but it still amazes me that people can do that, and that's fantastic for them, you know. But it's just was never for me. The nights I ruined for myself more than anything, just standing at a bar,
mm-hmm.
you know, just you know, going to a party and just standing at a bar, or having to go home early because it was like a race to see how much I could drink in a short period of time.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. You know, and being shut off to society, you know, just having that the blinkers on and having no real connection with anybody.
Yeah.
For me, I used to go to things thinking that I was there for, you know, the individual or the friends,
mm-hmm.
but I was only there if there was alcohol involved.
Mm.
You know, I was only really there if there was a drink involved in it for me.
Mm.
And that in a nutshell, you know, was my drinking pattern, and was the way that I drank for a long period of time. And it's hard for me to kind of look back and talk about, I don't mean hard, but it's hard for me to look back and actually now think about what my mindset was, because I was in such a dark place, but mm-hmm. I didn't know it. You know, I didn't know that I was in that dark place.
Oh, yeah. And that's scary.
Yeah, and that is scary. And when you start to come out of that, you know, you start to, you know, open up your eyes, and you start to look at what actually, you know, makes you tick as a person.
Mm-hmm.
That's when, for me, when I started to feel freer and lighter because I was carrying around some amount of baggage for years.
Yeah.
You know? And things that I didn't even think annoyed me or bothered me, you know, that was the, you know, that was what made me tick. And it wasn't, you know, it really wasn't a good place to be. And I don't really know if it wasn't for, you know, coming to the very end of the road for me, was basically going back to last summer, was basically, you know, drinking and then going to my work on the Thursday and coming home and my partner just saying, you know, I think I'm going to leave.
Oof.
And I'm not saying I get into recovery because she was going to leave me.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I don't know, she might still do, who knows. But at that point, I kind of went, okay. And that wasn't me. For this alcoholic, I would fight and scrap for any little thing to keep me to keep me looking good, you know.
Yeah.
And I would always be the one that would say, why would you want to leave me?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so far removed from reality. I suppose I laugh, but I only laugh because it's so serious, you know.
It's pretty much all you can do.
Yeah, it's either that or else you'll turn into a bubbling wreck again.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. And I kind of went, okay. And I suppose that was the first time that I really accepted that, you know, if I just continue to be the person that I'm being, then, you know, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. And for 2 days, I lay in bed. And again, you know, I must have had the DTs, you know, withdrawals and all these sort of things. But again, you know, that was, you know, not anywhere in my thinking at the time.
Because
I didn't know really about what I suffered from, to be honest. I just knew a couple of things. I had to stop drinking and I couldn't stay stopped.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I really knew.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the starting point for me. And I suppose part of my journey was basically lying in bed and just, you know, just saying over and over to whatever it might be, you know, the universe,
mm-hmm.
you know, God, higher power, whatever anybody wants to call it,
and just
help me.
Mm-hmm.
Just help me. Because whatever little bit of fight was inside me, it was nearly gone, you know, it was nearly gone.
Yeah.
And for me, we all have our own journey, and some people, you know, do, you know, lose absolutely everything. I only, you know, thankfully, you know, to this point today, I've still got some of the things in my life that I spoke about, house, kids, partner, those sort of things, but I've only got them today because of hitting that rock bottom for me.
Yeah. You know,
hitting rock bottom is the best thing that ever happened to me,
mm-hmm.
because it gave me that glimpse into what was going to happen. And what was going to happen was I was going to end up with nothing, basically.
Yeah.
But that was really what was coming for me. And I knew it because it just descended into that, you know, there was no fun in drinking anymore. I didn't want to drink with anybody. I just wanted to drink on my own. And if I did, I mean, for me, if I went to anything, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years and there was alcohol involved, you know, I did want to be there, but I was happier when I got home and I could just drink on my own.
Yeah.
You know, because then I didn't need to try and be nice to people and,
mm-hmm.
Oh, all these things that just come with it, you know, and it's tough, you know, having addiction and and having and putting a mask on every day is, it's so tiring.
Yeah. You know,
and then going into work and pretending that everything's okay when really inside and your family life is all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
It's scary how long, people can go on for. I just couldn't go on any longer. I'm 33. I was obviously 33 at that point of time, and I'd really been drinking in the same sort of pattern since I was 15, 16.
Yeah.
How I'm still here because of some of the situations I got myself into, falling asleep in public areas. Being in police cells because I'd fallen asleep at bus stops and all these sort of things, all the things that if anybody had said to me at the age of 16, you're going to start drinking and this is what's going to happen to you,
mm-hmm.
I would have laughed and said that's never going to be me.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all those things happened.
Yeah.
And for a while you wore them as a badge of honour. Sometimes you would say, ended up here or whatever, or I fell asleep on the bus or I fell asleep on the bench or whatever it was. So those things are funny, I suppose, on a one-off occasion, but when it starts becoming a pattern,
mm-hmm.
And when my trigger should have been when I was 18. I lost my driving license when I was 18 for drink driving.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a drink awareness course at that time. But you're too young at 18. Well, yeah. I was too young at 18.
Yeah.
To be an alcoholic and to stop drinking. That was never going to be an option for me, and I had to take the journey that I've taken, and it's not a journey that you would want anybody else to take. Everybody, what's amazing about recovery for me certainly is everybody's journey can be so different.
Oh yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, everybody gets to that point where whatever spirit is inside is nearly extinguished.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you then get just that little bit of fight to then seek recovery, that's what then binds us all together,
Doesn't matter
where you are in the world, mm-hmm. there's that understanding and respect to what everybody in recovery has to go through, because it's certainly... I think when I first decided, right, okay, I'm gonna stop drinking and go and seek people to talk to that might be like myself.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I would be, where I am now after just 7 months, or certainly not, because all I wanted to do was learn how to stop drinking.
Yeah.
I just thought there was some sort of formula,
mm-hmm.
Some sort of equation, some sort of magic trick. I don't know, could I be hypnotized to stop drinking? could you be hypnotized to, only drink a certain amount?
Yeah.
That's really where I wanted to be, because I thought, even at that point when I knew I had to stop, the thought of stopping was frightening. Mm-hmm. really, really scary. Because if I'm still considering myself fairly young at 33, I'm mm-hmm. thinking, what's my life going to be like? How can I socialise? How can I do anything like that?
Yeah.
So even though I knew that I had to stop and I had to, find out, what the situation was, I do remember, that first week was amazing in some ways, but every now and then you would get that feeling, like what's going to happen, in mm-hmm. a couple of years' time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also, I don't know, I haven't spoken to many people that have been like this, but I was very obsessed with how long people had not been drinking for.
Yeah.
So as soon as I met somebody, I would ask them straight away, so how long have you been sober for? Mm-hmm. And I was just, I didn't really know what I was looking for. I suppose I was looking for that one person that had been sober for a long time that would go, that's not worth it. maybe that's what I was looking for, I don't know. But the amazing thing is I never found that one person.
Yeah.
Because they just kept asking me, so how long have you not been drinking for? And I would say, a week or whatever it was, you know, a couple of days. And the look of sheer joy in their faces, for me not drinking for a week or whatever it was amazing. And I was, that's what kept me, going and talking to people, because I thought, well, why are people interested in me?
You
know, what's so, I mean, you know, what is so amazing, or not amazing, but what is so kind of attractive to someone that hasn't had a drink for 35 years, talking to somebody that hasn't had a drink for 3 days? You know, I just didn't understand it. That obsession of Lent for sobriety left me fairly quickly, purely because you know, I discovered that I feel good today, and I felt good today, but it's only today, you know. And when I started to break it down like that, the whole fear about 10 years and or whatever it might be in the future just started to leave me.
Yeah,
because certainly, you know, for this alcoholic, if I start, you know, looking at the future, and the mind starts to play tricks again like the old days. And I certainly don't want to go kind of back there. But
no.
I mean, for me, it was learning, you know, how to stay sober, and for that, for me, it was really just getting involved in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the starting point for me.
Mm-hmm.
Reading the doctor's opinion for the first time ever, I read how I was feeling and I read how I drank.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like someone was basically saying, right, we've been watching you for the past X amount of years, and this is what we've seen.
Oh, I know, it's weird.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter how long ago that the words were written. It was like it was literally written as I was kind of reading it. You know, it was coming alive to me, and that, I think that was the turning point for me, because I think I was ready. I was open minded, and my heart was open, and my eyes were wide open to the fact that there was all these people that I was coming in contact with that had smiles on their faces, and they looked as if they were enjoying life.
Yeah.
And I thought I was enjoying life. But I knew deep inside, you know, like, when you're that person who would be happier when everybody in your house is in bed sleeping, and you can just sit and watch television on your own and just drink, you know, like, that's sad. You know, that is a real sad existence.
Yeah.
I would have been the person who, if I'd talked to anybody like that, or seen a television programme with somebody like that, I would have gone, oh, that's a shame. You know, that person needs help.
Yeah.
That was me.
Yeah.
You know, that was me. I was so far gone. But really, yeah, I mean, getting a... For me, getting a sponsor was massive. Has been massive in my journey.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
just somebody who isn't there to agree with me and everything.
Yeah,
it's just somebody who, you know, it was like a gut feeling that I had when I met my sponsor, that person was going to be my sponsor, and I can't explain, you know, what it was. you know, potentially, in my mind, quite clearly, it was my higher power saying, like, this is where you need to be, and this is who's going to be your sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what happened. You know, my experience was very much, I came into, Alcoholics Anonymous and asked, what do I need to do? So I did it. I got a sponsor and I joined a group very quickly because I was like that, right, well, I can see people looking good. I need a bit of that in my life.
Yeah.
And then I just started embarking on the 12 steps.
Mm-hmm.
And really didn't know anything about it apart from, I suppose, what I'd read or heard and,
mm-hmm.
you know, social media and on the television and
yeah,
because certainly I think, you know, in North America, certainly in America, the 12 steps is a massive thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, it's everywhere.
I mean it's huge. It's getting bigger over here, but it's taken a little bit longer to become the norm when you hit recovery.
Yeah.
Certainly. In the areas that I kind of go around in Glasgow and stuff, but for me it was it was paramount because my sponsor said, "Well, this is what I've done, and this is where I am." And I went, "Well, let's have a wee look at it then." And
mm-hmm.
and that's what I did. I couldn't really do it any other way because I knew that doing it my way. Just didn't work.
Yeah, wasn't working anymore.
No, it wasn't working. You know, stopping for a couple of weeks, a couple of months was all fair and well. But when I found out or read Doc's opinion and realised that what I had was, you know, this allergy, this manifestation of this physical reaction to alcohol,
mm-hmm.
I understood it, and I understood it because that was me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always intended to have one or two and never did.
Yeah.
I always intended to come home when I said I was going to come home.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did. And these were all the little things that I kept reading and seeing and talking about. And then people were just saying to me, do the 12-step program and see where it takes you. And
mm-hmm.
the first couple of steps were fairly straightforward for me. I know a lot of people, and I've got a lot of friends, and social media is really, really good for it, you know, that conversation about higher powers and things like that, you know,
because
it's a hot topic, you know, that mm-hmm. but for me, I can only be grateful, and again, it's only my journey, but I can only be grateful that I came into this with still a glimmer of faith in my life.
Yeah.
And for me, that was just part of my journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, looking back in it, the whole fact of handing your will and your life over to a power greater than yourself, that really happened to me. You know, 2 days after I stopped drinking, when I was lying in bed crying, asking for somebody to help me,
yeah.
You know, I decided that for me was my, my third step was really then. Obviously, I didn't know it at that point in time.
Yeah.
But that was really me saying something has to give.
Yeah.
You know, something has to give in. And so, it's, you know, that side of things for me was absolutely no issue at all. But I fully understand, and it's amazing the conversations that I can now have with people who have reservations, you know, about that area, because I'm just, after going through, you know, the program and looking at what makes me tick, my resentments, my fears, my, you know, how I ran on fear. one of the biggest fears that I had, and it's something that always kind of comes back to me, was for some reason I was scared of the dark.
Mm.
I don't know why I was scared of it. Maybe because my mind was in much darkness. I didn't want to be any darker. And I don't know what it was.
Oh yeah.
Since I've gone through, steps 4 and 5, and 6, 7, and 8, and it came to me one night when I was sitting in my house on my own, looking out the window, and for some reason I never used to like that. I don't know what it was about just looking out a window at night. I just didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I realized I wasn't scared anymore.
Mm.
I realized that I didn't have anything to be fearful of.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never scared of the dark when I was drinking.
Oh no.
So that was always I suppose there's a lot of amazing things, but that's just something that always comes back to me, because I think that's the fear that I had for a long, long time, from when I can remember. The earliest kind of fear that I had was the dark. But again, it's freeing that I don't have to have that in my life anymore. And I think just progressing through recovery, comes with so many amazing things, but also, it's tough. It's not easy, because if it was easy, everybody would do it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the biggest things for me. When you talk to newcomers or people that are asking questions, in your life, workplace, social media, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's hard to take that step back and remember where I was.
Yeah.
And I have to remember that 8 months ago, if someone had said, fast forward and you'll be, talking the way I talk now and sharing my experience across multiple different platforms,
mm-hmm.
That would be the most laughable thing in the world, because, there wouldn't have been any reason for me to do that, because I wouldn't have had a problem. But
yeah.
At the end of the day, I was asking questions for a long time, and I suppose if anybody comes to me now and starts asking questions, I just need to remember that, I have to be compassionate and kind and understanding to how they're feeling, because if anybody, I know it so well. For years, people said to me I had a problem with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And my attitude was to say, well, I'll show you who's got a problem with alcohol, and I would just drink more.
Yeah.
If somebody tried to take alcohol away from me, I would just try and drink it all before they could. because that was my choice, obviously,
Yeah.
that was just the way it went for me. But, just going through everything and then getting to certain points where you really have to delve deep. It's a freeing experience, When I talk to people about doing step 4, I remember when I was starting to write things down, I didn't think I was going to be able to write anything down. I had to, eventually my sponsor had to say after about 3 or 4 weeks, I think you should stop writing now. because it was amazing, because I just, all these little things, all these little nuggets that they were chipping away at my soul for such a long time.
Ooh, yeah.
were the things that were kind of making me tick.
Yeah,
and for no, when I really break it down, for no reason whatsoever, I was a prisoner to my own resentments. Resentments being the number one killer. I was a prisoner to my own resentments for so long.
Yeah,
and I always remember somebody saying that, and I like this sort of thing. As an alcoholic, it's not the big things. It's not like the lions and the tigers and the elephants in the jungle that will get me. It's the little creepy crawlies, the little insects and the wee beetles, those little things. They're the ones that will get me.
Yeah.
They're the ones that I drank on for years. Mm-hmm. You know, the little things. You turn on the news and something happens in the news and it just sets you off. You know, all these little things that, mm-hmm. that always kept me going for so long. And then when you get it down and you say, you know, what was this actually for?
Yeah.
And it was just to fuel my own pride, ego, you know, my own, you know, all these sort of things, you know. And when you really break it right down, it's just pointless. You know, it's just really, really pointless. And that's, I just try and keep it as simple as I can daily, because you do that and then you talk to somebody about it. And the amazing thing is, in recovery, and again, it doesn't really matter whether it's, you know, alcohol or whatever the addiction is, it all stems from the same thing. You know, it all stems from hunting for that one thing that's going to make you feel that bit better about yourself. Mm. Or even just that one thing that's going to make you forget that little annoying, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why talking to other people in recovery, it's just the most freeing thing in the world. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Because I can say some mad stuff. I think we can all say some mad stuff.
Personally. Oh, yeah.
I can certainly say some stuff. And when I say it... with friends in recovery or put it on online or whatever, you get a good response from other people who are in recovery. And when you try and say something in the workplace and people then look at you, you realise that, you know, it's... For me, it was funny because it just made me realise, well, I'm in the right place if I'm talking to the right people. You know, and it is quite funny though because... You then start to have people in your own life that think, well, who may or may not have any problems. And then when you start talking to them and they start agreeing with you, then that's maybe when I need to start speaking to them even more.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but no, I mean, really, for me, the 12 steps, in a nutshell, is my guide to life and to living on a daily basis. But that's really it. Mm-hmm. It's really a daily thing, you know. Going through it all, the major problem for me was overthinking things, you know.
Oh yeah.
You know, should I say this? Shouldn't I say this? Is this right? Is that wrong? There's no right or wrong when it comes to recovery, because my recovery is my recovery.
Yeah.
And I don't need to. The good thing is I don't need to have someone saying, there's a gold star, you know, that you've done it the best that anybody's done it.
Mm-hmm.
I can only do it the best that I can do it. Mm-hmm. And that's, and again, that's absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And actually being accountable as well. I suppose the big thing is, I don't know if you ever got to, well, but I can get to the point where if I do or say something that isn't right, it hits me immediately.
Oh yeah,
not right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's new, you know. And that's for me, obviously, where you know, step 10 comes in, and you're continually looking at yourself and making sure that you're conducting yourself correctly, you know. But it's an amazing feeling being able to look at yourself in a truthful way and say, you know, did I do everything today that was good?
Mm-hmm.
What could I have changed? And for me, that then means that when I get up tomorrow, I can then look at that and say, right, well, I know where I need to improve. And it's just for me, I have to keep it as simple as I can. Because if I overcomplicate it, it just gets blown into all, you know, it just gets blown out of all proportion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think you want recovery to be as attractive as possible, because if it's not attractive and we don't have people you know like yourselves and creating that conversation, you know, because there's so many people out there who are where I was, you know, struggling for years, you know, thinking that there was a problem and not wanting to admit it, you know. And I just really see that the journey that I certainly went on, you know, if I can help one person other than myself get out of that darkness, that's really all that I can do. Because if we can all just, you know, help one other person, and I know we can do lots more, but I think if you can help one other person get to that point where they can then help someone else, I think that's as simple to break it down for me. And that's why, you know, I owe everything. Personally, myself, I owe everything to the 12 steps, because it's given me back my control. As in, what I mean by that is it's given me back the control to know that I don't need to be in control.
Yeah.
I always kind of confuse when I say that, but I don't want to be in control anymore. I just want to be in control of knowing what I need to do, which is, you know, asking for guidance on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know, I can control my own recovery by following the 12 steps.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I let go of that, then that's me then trying to take back control of my own little universe.
Yeah.
And that's where, for me, the breakdown happens, you know. And I think surrendering, a lot of people say, oh, I said to somebody once, you've just got to let go.
Yeah.
And they said to me, what am I letting go of? And he says, well, you've just got to let go of what you know is right, or you feel is right. That's because the only way that I could get into recovery was to go against everything that Richard thought was right.
Yeah.
And go completely against my norm. Because you have to turn yourself around 180 degrees.
Yeah.
And if you can do that, then you've got half a chance, I think.
Oh yeah.
And that's really it for me in regards to my recovery.
All right.
That was great. That was a great message.
Yeah, man.
Well, we have a few questions, right?
Yeah. You want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. You've been starting lately, so I'll start. So the first question I have, you know, I mean, so you've been in the States and, you know, lived in the Americas for a little while. But I know that culturally there might be, you know, obviously I'm not, you know, I've visited Europe. And at the time, I mean, I was clean when I did, so I didn't really experience it from, you know, drinking or drugs. But is there, it seems like, at least culturally from, like, media, it seems that there's, you know, kind of like, oh, well, you know, you guys drink more, or you smoke more cigarettes or something. Like, I don't know, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
kind of,
no,
like,
I hear
it
you.
Just seems like you guys can handle your alcohol a little bit better than we can.
Yeah, in America, when we think about, like, Irish people and
Scottish
British
or you all of that.
Going down to the pub, having a good time, just drinking your faces off.
Yeah, and being able to handle it a lot better than us. Like, do you, like, is it harder because you, like, I don't know if that's an accurate description because that is the media's description, but is it culturally more acceptable to drink, you know, to have a drink every day? Is it, like, more acceptable over there than it is over here?
I would think that, there is very much a culture of no matter what you're doing, there is always alcohol involved in it, but not just alcohol involved in it. There's very much a culture of you're going to go and you're just going to drink and drink. And there's a lot like that. I would say what I've had my eyes open up to is, I suppose, the difference between myself as an alcoholic and a heavy drinker. I suppose that's the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. Is trying to get that definition. But for me, it's quite hard. But I would say that there's quite a lot of people who could potentially be heavy drinkers. And what I mean by that is they'll go out every day and they'll just drink, you know, they'll maybe drink 6 or 7 pints. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I've got a bit of a cough coming on. Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. But then they'll be able to stop at that and go home. Mm-hmm. Does that classify as a heavy drinker? Maybe. But I could never do that. But I wouldn't drink every day. Mm-hmm. So I think there is, historically there has been very much I would probably call it a community around, you know, pubs and things like that. It is changing potentially a bit more now in the UK. Again, you know, don't quote me, but there has been studies done where, you know, children now that are, you know, been born in 2000 and up sort of thing, are drinking less. Hmm. And for example, my generation, you know, there is discussions around that. So culturally, I think there are things changing. There's a lot more, I would say, people drinking for the social aspect. Mm-hmm. But then it's mindful of the fact that, you know, for me, it really doesn't matter how much someone does or doesn't drink. Alcoholism is, I suppose, it's far more complex than just how much you drink. I suppose that's what makes it harder for people to understand, you know. I suppose that the best thing that I've heard, you know, I suppose, and I don't know what it's like with yourself in the States, but I've heard a lot of women talking about their issues and, you know, having one glass of wine a night. And I've actually got a friend who has discussed things with me, and, you know, one glass of wine a night, and you know, they've got a family member who, if they don't get that one glass, then that's an issue for that one person.
Yeah.
It's again just that routine, mm-hmm. You know, that habit, that control. But yeah, I mean, the UK, Scotland, Ireland, you mentioned that, you know, I didn't have an alcohol problem when I went over to Canada, mm-hmm. Because I was Scottish, and this is how we drink in Scotland. And then my family in Canada would like to have a whiskey or a couple of beers, but that was it. And I used to think that there was a problem. You know, I would be like, you know, what's the problem here? Why can't we just go out and, you know, go out and drink? But they didn't have the friends that I had.
Yeah.
They friends loosely. Drinking companions more than anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's the big thing is perceptions are one thing. I think Scotland and Ireland and things like that, I've probably run Scotland's tourism is a lot of it based on whiskey, you know? Mm-hmm. which is amazing if you can enjoy one whiskey of an evening. Mm-hmm.
I never could.
Oh, yeah. An expensive bottle of scotch would be paid on me, you know. It's everything. I'm certainly not one of these individuals who is, anti-alcohol. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, for my partner, for example, we were sitting watching a movie last night and she had 2 glasses of wine and mm-hmm. then went to bed. You know what I mean? That's not a problem. You know, that's maybe once a month, for example. Mm-hmm. But it's, for me, I have not got that kind of stigma. It still surprises me that she can do that. I sit there watching that glass of wine and she nurses it all night thinking, you know, just drink it, you know. it's amazing how, I know exactly where you're coming from, because certainly when I ever visited, Canada, I always just, I'll show you how to drink. That was my attitude.
Yeah. I'm Scottish. I know how to handle my shit.
Exactly. I'll show you how to do it, and I would be the one sliding up and down the bar, you know. I do like the hearing how other people or how we're perceived, but again, it probably would be something that's well served tourism as well. Go to Scotland, go to Ireland, go to these events, and because there's plenty of Irish and Scottish events across America and Canada, and it's all fueled by the same thing.
I think of like Oktoberfest, right? Like any Oktoberfest you go to, it's just a beer garden.
You think about Germans, think about
that's people, all it is. It's all based on just drinking
beer and sausage.
good combination.
exactly.
It's all about that perception. Who does it benefit? Obviously it benefits the companies and stuff like that. That's good on them, because there'll be plenty of people who can enjoy these festivals and all those sort of things. And I just, couldn't. I said, but the one thing was, last night my partner said to me, we were watching that movie, A Star Is Born, quite fitting, considering what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And then we started talking about music, and she said, it'll be really good to go to, a music concert or something with you, and you will actually be able to remember it. And
yeah.
I said, yeah, suppose so. Because that, again, was, something that I spent some money on and just never remember the end of the night, And that, again, was just so common for me. When I think back on it, I try not to live with regrets these days, because living with regrets will only bring back those resentments. So it's not so much a regret, because it's part of my journey, but I suppose what it has done to me is it's given me that excitement to actually go to a concert again and be able to enjoy it and enjoy the music and enjoy enjoy the event for what it is, instead of what it was for me, which was that excuse, that was the big one. Come to Scotland, I'll show you how to drink here.
All right, well, I got a question for you. I think sort of like you talked about it a lot, and I think it's pretty common amongst like addicts and alcoholics, is that like illusion of control while like simultaneously being in like a state of denial about like where we're at, like not having a problem. Like me personally, when I was in like active addiction, I knew I had a problem, but I thought like my problem was drugs and like drugs and alcohol. And I didn't realize that I was the problem and like drugs and alcohol were the symptom. So, how big was it like sort of, changing that status quo in your mind of like that illusion of control, like getting out of that denial and for the first time, like holding yourself accountable and being responsible for your recovery. Like how paramount was that?
It was massive for me. I've got one prime example for that. And you said it perfectly about having that control, but being delusional as well. There was a point in time when I was asked by a manager, by two managers at my place of work, if I had a drink problem. Now, this was because I'd taken a day off work, and obviously it came to light that I'd had a drink the night before. In that split second, I thought to myself, well, if I say I've got a drink problem, then they're not going to fire me because they can't fire an alcoholic.
Ah.
So I thought I was being clever, and I said, yeah, you know, I've got a drink problem. So then they proceeded to try and help me. Now, this was about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I'd fooled them, because I admitted to them that I had a drink problem, but I wasn't admitting to myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's how delusional I was. So coming to that realisation that actually back then, somewhere inside me knew that I had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It was Ed that was telling me that I didn't.
Wow.
And then, like you say, realizing that I didn't have any control over that. So letting go of that factor was the first point where I was actually, you know, in a strange way, starting to take control of my own recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was me admitting, you know, like right at the very beginning, you know, of the steps, you know, looking at that second part of step one, that my life was unmanageable.
Yeah.
You know, for how long did I live thinking it's all manageable, it's fine, everything will be fine, I'm doing this and that. But really, all I was doing was running around little bits with that one thing in the middle of it, which was alcohol, booze, you know. That was my gravity pull, was bringing me back to alcohol and every turn that I was making. And then taking control of your own recovery by letting go, you know, and I know it sounds, I know you guys understand what I'm saying here, you know, you just let go, but then in that same moment of letting go, you actually inadvertently take control again. It's an amazing twist for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's that psychic, it was really that psychic twist, but I kind of went, you know what, I'm just going to let go of all that I kind of know and control, and if whatever happens, whatever anybody says to me, I have no control over that.
Yep.
But what that then gives me is control over my own recovery.
Yep.
Because you're then turning around and saying, you know, I've got a choice today whether I'm going to let the weather, you know, whether I'm going to let the rain bother me, you guys, the snow. You know, whether someone in work's going to annoy me, you know, children are a blessing, but my goodness, the test you recovery.
I'm sure.
You know, all these little things, am I going to let them annoy me? Because I can't control any of that. Mm-hmm. I can't control what anybody says to me, what anybody thinks of me. So you know what, I'm going to let go of that. And then that same breath, that then gives me full control of my own recovery. It's amazing. It's really amazing. And it's freeing, because some people call recovery, you know, a selfish act, for example, because you have to be selfish for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take control of that. For me, I can understand that. For me, it's really being... it's not selfish in the way that we used to be, or I used to be. It's selfishly being, if I look after my recovery, everything that touches that recovery then benefits.
Yeah.
I don't have an ABC list or a 1, 2, 3. What I have is I have recovery in the middle of a circle.
Yeah.
And it's my new kind of eight ball. And everything else around about it, your family, your partner, my kids, even my dogs, my work, whatever it may be, everything is just kind of circling around that recovery. And if it touches it and my recovery's good, that ripple effect, it just goes out the way. And things start becoming a little bit easier, slowly but surely.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. For me, it's amazing. Letting go on one hand, and then you fully then can take control in the other. It's good.
Yeah, it's definitely a freeing experience, and definitely like a revelation in recovery for sure. All right.
Oh, yeah.
I got a I'll ask two questions. One's a really easy question. This is a fun question. Because, like, you talked about having, like, the difference of having, like, your liquor stores and then, like, also having stuff in grocery stores. Is it hard sort of dealing with it, like, in, like, being so public? Because here in America, like, there's even, like, you can go to, like, some gas stations and they'll have alcohol. Mm-hmm. And in the South, they have these things called brew-throughs, where it's a drive-through liquor store, which is so weird. You have somebody behind the wheel of a car ordering alcohol.
So convenient.
It's like so convenient, but like scary and hysterical at the same time. So like, I don't know. Is it ever weird, like being in public and like just seeing like how prominent alcohol is everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but when you stop doing something, it then seems to be everywhere.
Oh, yeah. So, 100%.
Social media, every advert that pops up on social media, on the television, It just seems to be, obviously it's not any different than before, but it's just your mind is just, you know, sponging that stuff in. For me, it is surprising, I suppose, looking at it, just how accessible it is. Not as accessible as a drive through yet in Scotland.
Hopefully not, because it's a terrible idea.
Yeah, they haven't quite gone that far. For me, my experience has been from those days where I was really, you know, praying for someone to help me.
Mm-hmm.
I can only say that since then, and again, higher power playing a big part in this, I haven't really wanted or desired alcohol at any point of time up till today, as in right in this moment. Mm-hmm. Whatever comes tomorrow will be tomorrow.
Yep.
So for me, the answer would be not a huge issue yet, but I do know that it is everywhere, you know. Little shops that we have on the high street, you know, majority of places do have a license.
Mm-hmm.
But the big thing in Scotland is, and we're the only country in the UK at the moment, is we've got an alcohol tax very similar to Canada now.
Mm-hmm.
On our alcohol, so minimum pricing per unit. So that has taken away... certainly for me, what happened when that came in here is I stopped buying so much cider and I just started buying more vodka. Because it made more sense to drink the stronger stuff quicker and spend that little bit extra, but I was getting, you know, more alcohol, for example. That's what happened with me. I thought I was being smart, obviously trying to beat the system. That's what I was. But yeah, I mean, it is everywhere. And like you say, it cannot be a case, for me certainly, as an alcoholic, I'm never going to live my life or be able to live my life without being in proximity of alcohol. You know, that is just not...
It's not possible.
Feasible, you know? Yeah, it's not possible, you know? It is a legal drug. Every country government wants to sell it because, yes, it brings in revenue. I'm not stupid about that fact. It's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So what I had to do was learn how to basically just leave that in my life, not have that crutch.
Yep.
And I think that was the biggest thing because, yeah, I mean, I couldn't go into a shop without it being there. I don't know, can you, in the States, can you buy alcohol 24 hours a day, or is there a time period where you can't buy it, or...
No.
In the shops, in the liquor stores, or...
I mean, there's,
In the South, you can. Like, it's in a grocery store,
it's
that's
different
like 24...
states,
yeah.
It's have different rules, right? Like, I know in the county, that we live or you live in. No, neither of us live in.
Yeah.
But the county that I used to live in, you actually can't buy alcohol on Sundays. But that's just because it's a very, it had a very Catholic, yeah, it was very Catholic when it was originating, different laws.
And then you have like whole states like Utah where it's almost impossible to get alcohol anywhere.
Well, yeah, but that's like, that's Mormons.
Yeah. They're Mormons are weird. But still, like we hear stories of people who live in Salt Lake City, and that to get their alcohol, they'll drive hours upon hours to go to the next state over, and then right on the border, they have liquor stores waiting for those people from Utah who just need their alcohol.
You're not gonna stop an alcoholic, are you?
No, never that.
All right.
No.
And, all right, my final question of the night. And you talked about it a little bit, and we've had other speakers talk about it, how it really becomes it changes from being sort of like a social addiction or social drinking to really becoming an individual thing, and the drugs and the alcohol become our only friends, and, like, all of our relationships break down. So how big is it, and like how scary has it been to redevelop a lot of relationships in your life, like the relationship like with yourself, probably your partner, new people in the fellowship, and definitely a relationship with your higher power?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, with myself, because I think you start to learn about yourself, and it's kind of like meet, you know, kind of meeting a new friend again, and just trying to realise, getting rid of all the stuff that was the complete norm, and then looking at, you know, what the new life is going to be like. You know, it is really, you know, stripping it down and kind of rebuilding it, and each day is a learning curve. And I think that there's never going to be a perfect, for me, I'll never be a perfect, you know, I'll never be perfect in recovery, because there's just no such thing as that. But what I can do is I can learn from the mistakes and just kind of build on that and move on. That for me, because I always thought I was or wanted to be perfect, and again, learning that you can't be as freeing as anything else can be.
Oh yeah.
Relationships with the people within the fellowship. I've now got people that I can call a friend. You know, even, you know, as crazy as it sounds, you know, social media, you know, talking to you guys and little things like that, you know, there's a connection, and I touched on how there's a connection with anybody in addiction recovery that you cannot replace, because there's an understanding there, whether you talk a lot or you don't. There's just an understanding that we know where we're coming from, and that's just, you can't buy that, you can't sell it, you can't buy it. It's just there, and it's within us all, and that's what makes the whole kind of thing about, you know, the community of recovery so strong, you know, worldwide. Family relationships, you know, starting certainly you know, with my kids, starting to look at just be trying to be a better parent. You know, I love my children, but I did things that were crazy. You know, like looking after my children and drinking, and you know, all the things that, again, if anybody had said that to me, I would have, you know, I would have said some terrible things about anybody who would have potentially have done that. Well, again, it's just trying to build those relationships slowly but surely. I mean, the amends to my children is daily. It's as simple as on a Saturday morning, when I drop their mum off at work, doing something with them for a couple of hours.
Yeah.
You know, but not looking for it at the end of the day to say, well, I took them here, I'm going to have a drink. Just doing it because I want to do it.
Yeah.
That's all I can, that's really all I can do. And with my partner, it's, you know, we're going to be together 10 years this year.
Nice.
And it's, when someone mentioned to me, you know, when you come into the recovery and you've got somebody in your life who's stayed with you, then that person is a, you know, is a gift from your higher power.
Mm.
Because the question was asked to me, if my partner had done, you know, one of the things that I'd done, would I still be with them? Probably the answer would be no, because, you know, I was so perfect.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have dared to think that, you know, I would have been like that. So, again, it's just making sure that you start to do the little things again, like, you know, television, huge thing, you know. I'm still working on it, but I'm not to hog the television too much. You know, but it's a daily thing. You know, it's a daily thing. My partner was working from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. this evening. Oof. And it was just like, I stay quite close to where we work. We work in the same building, and I took her up some dinner, you know.
Nice.
It's things like that on a Sunday afternoon I would never have been able to do, because I would have been having a couple of drinks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I say a couple loosely.
Oh, yeah.
I say a couple. But it's little things like that. My wider family, I'm an only child, so I grew up with, you know, cousins who, again, I've got cousins in Canada who I'm extremely close to, even though they're obviously quite a distance away.
Mm-hmm.
I've got cousins in Scotland as well. And she just been able to build those relationships up again, because I was so self-centred that I didn't think that people wanted to spend time with me because they didn't like me or because whatever.
Yeah.
They didn't want to spend time with me because they were scared what I would do, understandably.
Yeah.
And now I'm able to talk to them and be part of their life and just be just be part of, you know, the universe, just taking over, you know. Not be, in my mind, not be the center of attention, but just be there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And again, my mum and my dad, yeah, also my stepdad, again, you know, he put up with some stuff that he shouldn't have had to put up with, but he stuck around. And, you know, you can be a biological father, or you can just be a father by choice, and he's definitely a father by choice, and he's a great granddad to the children. And again, that's a blessing in our life. And my mum has put up with me for since I was 15, 16.
Yeah.
And she always thought I had a problem with alcohol. But again, she knew people in the fellowship, but she didn't really know too much about alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't suffer from it, then why would you? Why would you need to have that? And she's probably learned a little bit from me as well, which is also good. And the last one, my higher power, that's been huge for me. Like I said, come from a religious background.
Mm-hmm.
My aunt's a Baptist minister, my mum's a Baptist, and we always went to church, so I would consider myself to be a child of the church, is probably what they call it. And that for me came with an issue, and the issue was I never felt like I was good enough for faith. I never realised that I had the ability to have the same relationship with my higher power, with God, that my family had, who were all, you know, very, very strong in their faith. I suppose I felt just a little bit inadequate when it came to that. I don't know whether that was probably just another notch on the resentment list, to be fair. But for me, in my journey, there was far too much happened that I couldn't it opened my heart and my mind to, or my eyes to, the fact that my higher power, God, had put situations, places, people in my path to take me back to my faith. But what I definitely do not do is put either faith or my religion above my recovery, or vice versa, because for me they come hand in hand.
Yeah.
My higher power brought me back to my faith, but my higher power also brought me into recovery. That is hugely important for me to remember, that without one, there isn't the other. And it's just the way that I certainly look at it. And it's been a growth in both areas. Everybody, I think that the journey with whatever anybody's higher power is, the most important thing for me, I think, is for anybody to potentially get over, just get onto that whole aspect of just letting go.
Yeah.
Whether that higher power is the universe or whatever fellowship they're in, the people within the fellowship.
Yeah.
I don't know. For me, it's God. I know, but I can understand it. What I have now is a relationship. I think if you get a relationship with whatever your higher power is, you then start to deal with things in a different way, because things just for me certainly start to become a little bit more transparent. I can just deal with things. I had a for me personally, I had a job interview on Tuesday in my work. I didn't get the job. Do you know what? I know that my higher power has a reason behind that.
Yeah.
And it really hasn't bothered me. And for the first time in my life, I can say, you know what? That was meant to be. And there'll be something else coming up. And all I can do is just tick on over and just keep moving on with that. But yeah, I mean, all those areas of my life have only been improved because of recovery, because of a higher power. Everything for me all comes together. I mean, it's without a shadow of a lie and without a shadow of a doubt, it saved my life. Because it might not have been this year or next year, but at some point, I would have died, at some point. Because there goes so far you can go. It's a journey. As we all know, anybody in recovery knows, it's a journey with its bumps and scrapes, ups and downs. But it's certainly worth it when you get to the top of that mountain and you can look out and say, this isn't bad. It looks all right up here.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah,
thank
man.
You.
You did a great job. We'd really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with us, man.
It's absolutely a pleasure. And I just look forward to, what the journey takes you guys on. And if I can be part of that, by all means, just give me a shout, because we've all get... the last thing that I always say to anybody is, we've all got a reason for being here. And there's so many people out there suffering, and platforms like this and social media, I think, are used correctly, are an amazing tool, an amazing tool to bring people in to maybe start thinking about things and then seek the help that they need to get. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to sign us out here, and then we'll call it a night here at Podcast Recovery. Here at Podcast Recovery, we are aiming to expand the scope of support for recovering addicts. Accessibility and convenience of helpful services is paramount to combating addiction. We work to bring the message of recovery to every addict, wherever and whenever it is needed. We believe that a powerful voice of recovery should be obtainable, practical, and at the touch of a button. Every addict deserves to hear a message of hope, and Podcast Recovery is here to provide it. All right, man, we'll... Can keep listening to us, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook. We're going to get an Instagram up soon. And yeah, man, let your fellowship members know. And like, we'll get some more of our Scottish family on here.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on.
Fantastic. Have a great night, guys.
You too, brother. Everybody stay safe. Stay clean.